Hi, this is Abraham Engel. Welcome to Neighborhood Diaries. In 2009, I recorded the location-based memories of Portland tours and wove them together into these free interactive audio tours. You can download more tours by searching for Hood Turkey in the iTunes Store or by going to my website at www.hoodturkey.com, where you can also check out my other projects. This project was supported in part by a grant from the Regional Arts and Culture Council and by generous folks like you. To find out how you can donate with one click, go to hoodturkey.com. Unless otherwise stated, all the memories you hear were recorded by me, and all the music underneath them was composed by me, but I had lots of help with editing and other things by the following amazing people: Johnny Toadvine, Lena Munde, Nancy Wong, Mia Armstrong, and Carl Hugo. Also, I want to thank all my friends and family. Alright, so listen up. This is how you use the tour. I'm not going to be giving you a lot of directions. They're free maps you can download at hoodturkey.com if you haven't already picked one up. This is the memory-only tour, which means that there's no music in between the memories. So when one memory ends, just pause your player and hit play again when you reach the next location. You can let the natural sounds of the neighborhood be your soundtrack. If this is the iPod-enhanced version, you'll notice markers in the timeline. This means you can skip and go back to memories as if they were songs. Even if you don't use the iPod-enhanced version, you can look at the map and see the times at which each memory is played, so you can jump around that way. One last thing before we start the tour. This is a really long tour. The memories are a bit more sprawled out than in some of the other tours, so feel free to break it up at your own discretion. You won't hurt my feelings by not hurting your feet. With that said, let's go to 1801 North Alberta, and we'll start the tour. A quick note on this first memory, it was sent in via email, something you should feel free to do as well. The quality is not quite as high as the interviews I recorded. Okay, thanks to everyone who donated memory, and or money, and or time. Thanks to Iraq for their support. Thanks to the bands for donating their music. Thanks to my friends and family, and thank you for listening.
So my friends and I lived in the Northwest, but we decided to move our musical operations that we had started doing guerrilla performances, really busking on the streets. We moved our operations from Northwest Portland, the Knob Hill area, down to Alberta, basically the Alberta Strip, and what would normally be where Last Thursday is held. So me and my friends had this great idea where we would play like Phil Oak songs or obscure material and kind of perform with lots of enthusiasm. And we did it up and down Alberta. There's a place called, I believe, The Nest or Crow's Nest. I think it's The Nest. And we played Misfits covers into the bar to rousing applause and even offers of free beer and corrections to lyrics. So people knew the Misfits songs. It was a great experience.
I killed a baby today. It doesn't matter much to me as long as it's good.
And this entire evening we did, I believe it was a Wednesday, we foregoed going to some open mic at the Alberta Public House, which I believe is off of 11th. And instead we decided to just go place to place to place, playing for anyone who would listen to us. And we got mixed reactions. Some people kind of walked down the streets and ran away. Some people listened. Other people tried to tip us. Girls were kind of about it, even though we had an equal amount of females with us. It was two guys and two girls. It was a good experience. And it was so good that we ended up playing in this restaurant's outdoor patio in, I believe it was last July. And one guy offered us a gig, and it was great. On the spot, after we played these people, he gave us free beer, free weed, you know, at an outdoor patio, no one really cares. So we got a gig, and it was for the following weekend. Now, if anyone knows anything about Portland or any of the people in Portland, is one, we have lots of musicians. Two, we have lots of flaky musicians. Three, we have lots of flaky musicians who don't show up to anything. So we had this gig scheduled for four performers with a complete art walk and everyone out there looking to sell their goods. and the streets completely packed. So we were scheduled to play this gig, and I use the term "we" as a term that no longer holds any relevance, as all my friends flaked out. One had work, one was too scared to go, one had school tests that they had to study for, even though this gig was... Yeah, they all flaked out. So I had to cull all the material that we did as a group, which was some original songs and some other goofy songs, and play a gig. Bad idea. When I got to the place, the owner didn't even recognize me alone from that, because he was expecting some band when he told us to play. Even though I had a guitar strapped to my back, he didn't recognize me. He didn't recognize anything. He didn't even know there should be live entertainment. He just kind of was aloof the entire time. So, it wasn't really happening. I waited around at the restaurant for half an hour. So, judging by the success of playing on the streets the previous night, I decided, let me do it myself. I'd done in the past, I hitchhiked across country doing it. What could be worse? So I kind of moseyed on my way after getting some Mexican food all the way up to 21st in Alberta, where there's like some sort of Mexican place. And some family asked me to play for them. I was like, oh, yeah, great. So they're asking me that you can't go wrong. Now, it was a blistering hot day. And I used the term blister because what did I play? Well, I played... Sorry, the Violent Femme song. This woman who asked me to play with had her small child by her hand and had a stroller with a kid and her, I guess her mom or something. And they asked me to play this song, and I was like, oh yeah, I know a song that'd be perfect. So I played the song, not thinking what the lyrics were, and the lyrics go, you know, man, I'm walking, I shut myself, and I'm so strung out. I'm high as a kite, and I just might stop to check you out. And I didn't realize, high as a kite, stop to check you out. Let me go on, blah, 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 blah. The song's really about drugs and sex and fucking and all that. And not really kid material. So when I sing, I usually close my eyes, because it's easier to remember lyrics than be distracted by an audience. And when I opened my eyes, the only thing I saw was the horrified expression of a woman advancing down the block, running away, my friend who I dragged along with me just looking in complete horror at my skill of maintaining an audience. And yeah, I didn't play a gig that day, so it was one of the worst days in Portland. But it was last Thursday, and I ended up getting drunk, and all was well. One last caress, one last caress of death.
Unfortunately, I can't tell you what address this next memory takes place at, but I have a fun little treat to make up for it. On the southwest corner of this intersection of Emerson and 18th, there's this plant, this big plant tree thing, and if you take a leaf off and smell it, it'll smell like something good. Not something bad, but don't eat it, because I don't know whether or not it can kill you. Okay, that's it. Enjoy the memory.
We moved into this new place. It's summer, and our two best friends, Dan and Dan, well, Dan lived here. He then moved down to San Francisco and met his new partner, Dan. And this is the first time that he'd been back to Portland since he'd left, and we were living in what was called the Hood, 18th and Emerson at that point, just off Alberta. Of course, Alberta had really been developed a lot more. We had gone off, I can't remember, to some play, I believe. And so they came home and they got the key from the backyard and got into the house themselves, back door. And by the time we got home, it was almost midnight. And of course they wanted to chit chat and hang out. So we were all sitting there in the front room. And a guy in a red sweatshirt runs past the side window that leads to the back garage and then into the backyard. And all you see is this flash of red. And we're like, what the hell was that? And at that point, three cop cars come up surrounding our house. We're like, oh shit, what the hell's going on? We had just been telling Dan and Dan that this neighborhood's really great. It's changed. Of course, they're looking at us like, changed from what? So I go into the back room, which is where they were staying, and the light was dark back there. But all the windows were open because it's summertime. And here's this kid climbing through the window. He'd broken the screen, climbing through the window. He's like, dude, let me in. I gotta hide. And I'm like, no, dude, the cops are here. You need to run. You need to run that way. Totally having this conversation. Dan and Dad had a little mutt dog that had run in and was just trying to jump up to the windowsill and get this guy, I guess. I don't know what he was doing. I'm pulling the dog off. I'm pushing the guy out the window. And all this time, our best friends, Judge and Eric, lived behind us in a two-story home that they had built. They're out on their deck calling Dustin, who's out front with the cops, to tell them that someone's breaking into the back of the house. Dan and Dad are in the living room going, what the hell's going on? Dustin comes into the back room, flips the light on. The guy had gone at that point. He's like, who are you talking to? What's going on? I was like, this guy's trying to break in. He wanted me to hide him. And Dustin's like, you didn't talk to him. He's got a gun. The police say he's got a gun. And I was like, he's already gone. And if he had a gun, he didn't pull it out to show me or anything. The cops bullhorn.
We are setting the dog loose. Blah, blah, blah.
2 minutes later, the dogs caught him. You hear all this commotion. And for the next 3.5 hours, they had a metal detector in the whole backyard, the bushes, every other neighbor's yard. Everyone's up because they're trying to find this so-called gun. They never did find a gun, but it gave us a good story.
These next two memories took place on the northeast corner of Roselawn and 9th. They were phoned in, so the quality of the recording is not as high as some of the other memories you'll hear.
So, it was like 2001. I think it was like November or something, so I remember it was really cold out. We just moved to Portland. Like, I'd been there maybe 2 or 3 months, didn't really know a lot of people, but I had this really shitty job, and it was just, like, horrible. I worked horrible hours and got paid no money, and I don't know, it was just a crappy job, and, like, basically it was just, like, I never did anything, and I was always broke, and it just pretty much sucked. At some point, I was just like, you know what, fuck this, I need to have some fun. So I decided I was gonna throw this little housewarming-ish sort of party, but just like a little get-together of like just the few people that I did know in Portland. And so we did, we had this party. We had a bunch of people over, and I went to the store and got a bunch of wine and beer, and it was good at first, and things were going on, and, like, you know, people were starting to show up. people were smoking and stuff, and so we had the door open, the front door. And eventually, this dude and his buddy, like, just walked in off the street. It was, like, this just, like, scummy-looking, kind of bummish sort of black guy and his, like, you know, equally scummy, bummy buddy just walked into the middle of my house. And, like, before I even knew what was going on, he had busted out this, like, bag, like this plastic bag filled with like shrimp and fish, and was trying to sell it to people in my living room. And it's like on my coffee table, and there's shrimp, just like, what the fuck? And I had to go up to him and I'd be like, dude, what's going on here? And he's like, hey man, this shrimp, I got this shrimp, it's fucking, it's good shrimp, dude, I'll sell it to you like $5, all this shrimp, $5. And it's like, what are you talking about? Like, get out of my house. And he's like, hey, man, you can't do that to me. Like, I'm an important person in this neighborhood. And he's like, what are you talking about, dude? You're trying to sell me shrimp in my living room. Who knows where the fuck it came from? This is ridiculous. Get out of my house, you know? Like, and it was just one of the most absurd things. And after a while, I was like, oh, yeah, I understand. I can understand where you're coming from. It's like, you got to be fucking kidding me. So this was like at our apartments. I was just like hanging out after work, and Scotty had gone off to the store to buy groceries. And he came back. He's like, hey, Wiley, look, you never believe what I got. And he's like laughing. I'm like, what is it? And he actually had bought 2 whipped cream pies from the store. He's like, they were like a quarter. And he's just like laughing. It's like, you know, like a whipped cream pie. And I was like, that's ridiculous, dude. And like, and we started talking about it and laughing about it, you know, and we were talking and the conversation moved on. And we had started talking about other things. But Scotty was still holding the whipped cream pie in his hand. And I had noticed that he was, so I was kind of just waiting for the opportunity to it. But eventually it did come up, and this was minutes later, like a long time later. And eventually he gave me the right prompt, and he said the right thing. And so I said to him, let me have it. And he didn't do anything. He didn't hit me in the face with a whipped cream pie. And I got so mad at him that I actually didn't talk to him for like 2 weeks.
This would be the 3rd bike accident that I ever got in. And I guess I don't want to give the specific address of this, but I got doored outside of a house that was near Northeast Mallory and Sumner, which is basically a block north of Alberta. During that time, I've pretty much always lived down in the lower Boise neighborhood, so I take Mallory as sort of my north-south corridor if I'm not going over to the east side of MLK. So I generally just ride down the middle of the street, and I'm pretty carefree because there's not, if there's a car coming, I'm going to see the car coming. But that time I had just enough time to see a door beginning to open in front of me, and it was just close enough to where I started to try to veer away to my left. It was on my right. Started trying to veer away, but I didn't make it in time. And so my handlebar impacted the door, and I go tumbling off my bike. And the funniest part was, you know, I hit the ground and I'm kind of just like dazed, but not too badly. I mean, I didn't break any bones or anything. But then I turn around and I've kind of got like, you know, I can see stars like in floating around my head or whatever. And then at the same time, I see the person getting out of the vehicle, and it's this girl that I recognize who I've sort of had a crush on. And it's funny because, you know, the stars are going at the same time. You know, I'm together enough that I can be like, oh, I know you. And I think that was her same response to me. And so anyway, I get taken inside and bandaged up, and she's feeling totally bad about the situation. And it was so funny because it's like, I was kind of hurt. Like, I mean, you know, over the next few days, my muscles were kind of aching and whatever. And I definitely had I have like a little bit of a scar on my hand that's still there. But it was just so funny because it was almost like this instantaneous mental change. Whereas if I had just been riding down that street and I got hit by somebody's door, that would have just ruined my day. That probably would have ruined my week. But there was something about turning around and seeing this girl and then being like, oh. And then when she was being so like, almost like a nurse or something, you know, being kind of like, oh, I'm so sorry. And so apologetic. I was just like, all I have to do now is just like say, oh, don't worry about it. No, it's no big deal. And I actually was, you know, joking with people later that I needed to really milk that situation. Like, I came back the next day and I think I got her number because she was having a yard sale and she told me I should come back and, you know, or so I came back and got her number, but then I never had any success after that with it. But I was just like, oh, you know, all I got to do is put the guilt trip on and be like, you know, you doored me, you owe me one, you got to go out with me. But anyway, so I know very well to pay attention to the doors that are, you know. Because ultimately, it's not worth. I mean, I don't want to gamble that it's going to be another hot girl who's going to door me.
My house at the time was on 7th and Going, the northeast corner of 7th and Going. It's this house that has like a hedge maze basically outside of it. It's a really nice house. The owner had gotten a new job suddenly and had to move out of town and didn't really have time to like sell it. And so she was just renting it. Eventually she did sell it and we had to leave because she was selling it. And now it's a daycare center. And it's been heavily remodeled, but it was built in 1896 and it was a really old, cool house. And we were living there and it was my first house in Northeast, and I was really stoked to have shows because I had been sort of commuting to these shows from other parts of town for several years. And we'd lived there for a while and we'd had a few shows. But my band was playing its first show in like a year and we didn't know if anyone cared really about our band. So we like promoted this show at my house like crazy, like just telling people all the time and texting everyone we knew and just hoping that like 30 people would come, you know. By the time the first band was starting at 9 o'clock, there was already probably 70 people there. And the first band had the crowd going so much already that one of the heating ducts from my basement was sort of crowd surfed out of the basement because it had fallen down from people like running into it and knocking their heads against it when they're moshing and stuff. And it just had to get out of there because it was just gonna get more and more destroyed. So people just crowd surfed it out. And when I saw that going down, I just decided to get hammered because I knew that, you know, my house was really in for it and I just didn't wanna watch that sober. So I got drunk and then my band played. And by this point, there was maybe 100 people or more crammed into our basement, and people on the stairs just like hanging their head down from the top of the stairs so they could get like one eyeball in the basement and see what was going on. And within about 45 seconds of our first song, someone grabbed a pipe, to stabilize themselves or something and broke the pipe, and it started spraying water all through the basement. And we got it turned off after about 10 seconds. And we decided to keep going with the show, even though we were standing in a puddle of water holding electric instruments, which was just like totally insane. The show went well after that. I mean, like, I've lost chips of my teeth from playing house shows, just from the microphones being knocked into my face by the crowd. And I actually didn't lose any teeth that night. I just remember being so close to the drum set that the cymbals would like hit me if I like went back, you know, even the slightest bit. And I couldn't move forward at all either because of the crowd. After the show, I was outside and someone comes up to me and says, "Hey, there's like a stripper at your house. Like, she's just here, you know?" And I thought, oh, that's weird. You know, it's not the weirdest thing that's happened tonight. So, you know, whatever. Like, and so I keep talking to my friend, and then someone comes back and says, you know, that stripper who's here is actually stripping now. Like, she's just stripping for no reason. And we don't really And I was like, okay, like, that's cool, you know? And then I keep talking to my friend, and then someone comes back and says, "The stripper who was stripping is now bleeding." And I go, oh my gosh, like, now I better go check this out. So I go inside, and there was this, I mean, it's been a funny story up to this point. It's kind of a sad story starting here. There was this woman who was a really tall, probably half black woman with long straightened hair and huge breasts. I don't know if they were natural or artificial, but they could have been artificial because they're very impressive, and they were also exposed as she was laying on my kitchen floor with a gash in her head. I asked around. Apparently she had been stripping sort of for fun, and people were into it, and then she just, this is what people told me, for no apparent reason, really started screaming at the crowd and throwing stuff at them, the crowd that had gathered to watch her strip. And so someone then threw a bottle at her and hit her in the head, and she was bleeding. And it wasn't like terribly bad. I mean, she wasn't like gushing blood everywhere, but I didn't really have like bandages in my house. So I got her like a paper towel and maybe some like tape or something. And we kind of made a makeshift bandage, and everyone cleared out of the room. Around this time, I realized she had to be on some kind of drugs because she was squirming around on the ground. And I said, like, okay, like, you know, like, you should probably go, you know, it doesn't seem like this is a very good place for you to be hanging out, you know, like, it doesn't, you know. And she kept saying that she wasn't going to leave with the Klan out there. And so she was convinced that people had thrown something at her because she was black. And I said, okay, like, I'll clear everyone off the porch so you can go. And so I went outside, and I was like, okay, everyone, like, she wants to leave, but she doesn't want anyone to see her, so everyone has to get off the porch and like go to the backyard so she can like leave and without being hassled. So everyone, like, I cleared off the porch, which is kind of hard to do because there's a lot of people there. And then I get back, and I say, okay, the porch is clear, like, you can go now. And she's like, I'm not leaving without my stuff. And apparently she had a suitcase full of stuff, and I just didn't know where this was. I asked around. Eventually the suitcase showed up, like, someone had found it and brought it to her. But before that happened, she was just sort of rambling on and on, you know, and my girlfriend at the time was just sort of, you know, felt bad for her because she'd had something thrown at her, and she was obviously, like, you know, having a really bad night, and just, you know, calling her sweetie and saying, like, you know, asking if she needs anything and stuff. And one of the times when I ran to go get the suitcase or clear off the porch or something, they somehow got into some sort of argument, you know. Later, my girlfriend told me that she had just sort of started becoming angry for no reason, which later I had reason to believe she was apt to do that. So she was going on and on about the Klan and all this stuff and how we were all racists. And my girlfriend said, you know, it has nothing to do with the fact that you're black, and it has everything to do with the fact that you're an asshole. And then the woman grabbed my girlfriend by the hair and dragged her across my kitchen floor by the hair until I smacked her arm really hard so she would let go of my girlfriend's hair. And then she grabbed my spice rack and threw it at me, like, shattering all these spices everywhere into the beer on the ground. So there was, like, this weird mix of spices and beer all over the place. And finally, I convinced her to leave and got her stuff together, and she was leaving the house, and she's standing on the porch with her suitcase, and The porch is pretty much clear, and there's one group of kids like in the street, maybe seven kids, and she drops their suitcase, runs down the stairs on my porch and goes, "I'll kill a bitch," and starts just punching these kids for no reason, and they just kind of panic and scatter, and I went, "Oh my God, this is insane," and I called the police in my own house, and eventually they came and took her away, because I just didn't know what else to do with this woman, and it just was really funny that all night I had been really afraid the police were going to come because this party was so huge. Like, it was destroying my house. It was so huge. But eventually I had to call them on myself, and they didn't care that we'd had a party, and they just took her away. The house was never really the same after that. No one who lived there really wanted to live there after that night. Somehow the stripper incident really just sort of soured the vibe at that house. Like, the oven had got like moved by the fight, and it was a few days before we put it back. Like, no one even wanted to set foot in the kitchen and deal with the mess of the spices and everything. And then, like, even once I did, it was never the same. Like, we were all just kind of, because by that point we already knew we had to move out. We'd been given like the word that we were gonna have to find a new place, and everyone was just kind of eager to move on, and that was like the end of the house basically. This is winter of 2006, 2007. I don't remember which one for sure, but it was that winter. The King neighborhood had been a really bad neighborhood for a long time. For most of the 70s, 80s, and even the 90s, it had been pretty rough, you know? And then it was getting nicer and gentrifying, and, you know, people with college degrees like me were like moving in after they finished their liberal arts college and stuff. And so anyway, it was getting nicer, but it still had this element of seediness. And in the particular way it was gentrifying was really friendly. I mean, there were these co-ops and things, like the community cycling center is one I went to a lot, where you could use their bike tools for free. And there were community gardens, and people would paint the street and stuff around their house. So it's very much like a really positive community. And also really diverse, one of the only really ethnically diverse areas in town. You know, you just get used to living in this hunky-dory world of, you know, everyone helping each other out and lending them their tools or whatever. So one night I was driving down MLK in my van. I turned onto MLK at Prescott and headed south. And I'd just been going a few blocks, and this woman sort of frantically was hitchhiking right there, just, you know, thumbing it on the side of the street. And she was there. You know, it looked like she was hitchhiking, and a while back I had picked someone up in a situation like this. A woman ran out in front of my car in another city and like just flagged me down, and I picked her up and drove her like where I was going, and she thanked me so much. She said she'd just been in a fight with her boyfriend and he was hitting her, and I totally saved her by like getting her out of there so fast, you know? So I thought maybe it was something like this. Like, this woman, you know, she looked kind of desperate, like standing on MLK. It was the middle of the night, like past midnight for sure. And so she gets in, and I was only going downtown, which like isn't that far, you know? And I said, I'm just going downtown. Like, I hope that's like where you're trying to get to. And she goes, that's not the idea. And I go, oh my gosh. I immediately realized I've accidentally picked up a prostitute, you know? And so I'm like, I'm so sorry. Like, I really just thought you needed a ride. You know, I don't need a prostitute at all. Like, yeah. And she's like, you know, that's okay. Like, will you just drive me around the block a few times so I can warm up? Like, it's really cold out here, you know? And I was like, sure. She was probably in her late 30s, and she was black, and her skin was really dry. Like, she'd probably been out there a long time. It wasn't raining that night. It was like a dry cold, you know, and you could see the wrinkles in her face and stuff. A while I'm driving around the block, before she'll really tell me anything about being a prostitute, she says, you gotta touch my breast. And I was like, I don't want to touch your breast, you know? And she's like, but it's the only way I'm going to know you're not a cop, you know, is if you touch my breast. And so she convinced me, and she basically took my hand and put it on her breast. And so then she was convinced that I wasn't an undercover cop and was willing to just, like, talk to me candidly. And I just sort of started talking to her, just because, like, you know, how often do you get, like, a prostitute in your car just to ask a few questions about being a prostitute, you know? And it came out that she was a student. She was studying nursing. I don't remember where, but and she just, like, had to be a prostitute to support herself while she went to nursing school, you know, which I thought was, like, a pretty sad story, you know? And I was working for a newspaper, and I actually got her phone number because I thought maybe I could do a story on her at some time. And then when I was going to drop her off, you know, I'd driven around a block a few times. I needed to get where I was going. And I was just like, all right, well, you know, it was really nice to meet you, like, good luck and everything, you know. And she's just like, come on, just let me give you a blowjob, come on. And I'm just like, I don't need a blowjob, like, I have a girlfriend, I don't really need one. And she's like, you know you need a blowjob, you know. And she seriously just would not get out of the car. She'd just be like, just $20, how about just $5 and I'll just touch it for you. And I was like, I don't want a prostitute, you know. So I finally just had to, just, I felt really bad because I already felt bad for her, because obviously her life was a really difficult life, and she was really worthy of admiration in a way, because she was, if nothing else, doing her very best to elevate her status in life, you know, turn to prostitution, like, something that most people would be really reluctant to do, and in order to work her way through nursing school. I mean, assuming her story is true, that's really admirable, you know. It's a huge sacrifice to get a nursing degree. So I already felt bad for her, but I really just couldn't get her to leave, and I ultimately had to yell at her and just be like, get out of my car, like, I don't want to hire you, you have to leave, like, you know. And yeah, so eventually she finally got out and slammed the door, really angry with me for not paying her for a blowjob.
That's where the police picked me up at a place on Lilio's one night, on Shaver and Union Avenue, which is MLK today. Lilio's was actually from Italy, I think. And the kids was in the back shooting craps. So there was a little 7-8-year-old kid in the back of a police car that night. About 11:30, we stopped to see what was going on. I'm 65 now, I was 40 years younger. I seen him in the car, and I knew him, and I said, what are you doing in here? He said, curfew violation. I said, oh, I opened the door, I said, you only live a couple of blocks away, you know. I said, take off, go home. You know, and that's when they grabbed me. And so they took me up to McDonald's. McDonald's was closed, it was 11:30 at night. So they used that as a staging area. And said he's swallowing something. But one went to stick his finger in my mouth, and then I come down on it, I bit down on it. You know, that's when they start beating me. I said, you motherfucker, stop beating me, and I turned his finger loose. But that time, blood was building on his finger, you know, I cut down real hard on it. He's jumping and screaming, he's got my finger, he's got my finger, he's got my finger. So I said, motherfucker, you make them stop beating me, and I'll let you go. I wasn't gonna let them go till they stop beating me, though, you know. And they snatched me out the car, worked me over pretty good. And so when I got to court, the judge, I said, what was it he was swallowing? He said, we don't know. So after they beat me, they put me back in the car and told me I've been charged with riot and inciting a riot. And I said, How did they get a ride in inciting a ride out of me letting the kid out of the back of a police car? Just something to keep me pinned down and keep me charged with. So I was in jail for 2 weeks. Come to find out what happened at Lidio's, I wasn't there. Police was chasing somebody and the policeman fell. But when the policeman fell, somebody kicked him as he fell. They said that I gave the orders to the guy to kick him. There's three or more people acting in concert. And I gave orders to the guy to kick him and the other guy that tripped him. But come to find out, I knew neither one of these guys because I wasn't even there. This happened at 11 o'clock. I didn't get there until 11:30. The DA there, he subpoenaed these policemen before the grand jury and told them what to say. And the grand jury documents everything. And then my lawyer read all this stuff, and then when the policeman me come to trial, he told a different story. So immediately my lawyer won the case right there within the first hour, and the trial lasted 2 weeks, because he said, I wanted this officer indicted for perjury, because he told one story before the grand jury and one story when he came to trial, you see. And so anyway, the jury came back. It was unanimous. The jury came back 12-0. The jury foreman was a custodian out at David Douglas High School, and he called me 7 days later and told me, you can see the case was bogus from the very beginning.
This location is MLK in Northeast Portland. The intersection of Monroe Street, north of the center median, in the middle of the boulevard, right in my neighborhood. I get off work in the evenings and had just gotten home. When I got out of the car, I heard a noise. Somebody crying, somebody screaming. Basically ran to the scene. I saw something completely different than I expected. Traffic stopped both directions. A crowd of people and a car that has come up onto the center median and had a frontal impact with a tree. There's kind of like smoke and blinker is still on and there's debris kind of scattered. And towards the back of the car, there's a scattered crowd of about 20 people. The first victim that I see was a young black girl. She was writhing on the ground. I have a wilderness first responder and have taken a few years of medical training and instantly realized that nobody was really kind of like stabilizing this young girl. She was just 16. As I approached and started stabilizing her spine and started giving some directions of what they should do to help her, including helping me hold her so that she was no longer kind of writhing in the street. She was screaming so bad, holding her knee that had assumed now was broken was the main bodily injury. A gentleman that was trying to help her had his hand on her knee, leaning in on it to try and talk to her and get information from her while she was screaming. When I realized what was happening, I asked him to leave and to not touch her knee anymore because he was squeezing probably her shattered knee and was causing her to scream so much while he was trying to help, not realizing it. He left. I talked to some of her friends that said that they had called the ambulance and her family. There were a couple other people that were just trying to tell me what had happened or what they had saw. I heard fragments of conversation, like she came out of the Popeyes parking lot and was going so fast that she lost control and fishtailed and crashed into the tree, and that kind of made sense. And I heard sirens in the distance and was just kind of hanging out, asked somebody to start taking notes and mark the time and take her pulse, had somebody get a pillow, had somebody get a blanket, was trying to talk to her. It was kind of funny to me because I've lived in the neighborhood for a few years and haven't had that much interaction with the African-American community. As a white person that had never really lived in an urban zone before with that much racial diversity, I was raised in a liberal but small, pretty much white town. It was just an interesting experience for me in general. That's the thought that was in my mind when I was trying to tell her to please stay still and not move because she could hurt herself worse. And all I could think about was the fact that she must think it's ridiculous that this pasty white boy is trying to tell her what to do when she's in the worst pain of her life. And how ridiculous it was, I thought in my mind that we were probably neighbors, but had never interacted before. And that it took an incident like this for us basically to be able to look into each other's eyes. The paramedics showed up. You know, I handed over the spine stabilization and just kind of stood up, and I've never been a fan of paperwork, so I walked up and walked away, and that was it.
Okay, thanks to everyone who donated memory and or money and or time. Thanks to Iraq for their support. Thanks to the bands for donating their music. Thanks to my friends and family, and thank you for listening. You can find out more about this and other projects at www.hoodturkey.com. Thanks, and have a safe trip home.